Hi, I'm Stacy B. from Seattle, and I am a grateful recovering alcoholic and a grateful member of Al-Anon. And as my sponsor likes to say, in good standing. Or actually, she doesn't mean that referring to me. She'll say, I'll ask her a question, and she'll say, what would a member in good standing do? So maybe she's not saying me, she's saying someone. I had all these notes. I forgot them all, which, you know, you should be glad. I've got a watch though, and I did want to say, I do feel everything I've heard, everything I hear in the rooms. I always just think everyone, this miracle, it just speaks through us, and everyone is so eloquent, and so when you're speaking the truth and the heart and the pain and the experience, it's just beautiful. And one thing I struggle with is comparing, and one of the things I learned, that one of the definitions of humility, apparently, is not comparing. That's a definition of humility. And then I've also heard compare and despair. So try not to do that. I'm so grateful to be here. I really am, and my sister mentioned before we started coming with my mama. There's my sister. And can I just say, again, I would like you to stand up, little sister. She's older than me, but this is Bonnie, my sister. Because, you know, my story is a lot of her story. We have a few veering off the road, literally and figuratively. But she's one of my spiritual mentors. And so this is, a lot of it's her, too. And Jim and Barbara, thank you for asking me to speak and for being my frannies. And my adopted mama. I kind of want to start with my new problem and how I got back to Al-Anon, and then my original problem. My new problem is when I got to the program for, you know, the first thing that was going to kill me is that's what the advice I got. Well, I didn't get advice, let's face it. I was intervened on, but that comes later. What's going to kill you first? And the problem for me is that apparently you can't keep this, you can't survive, you can't be sober, you can't be sane, you can't do anything unless you can give it away. Like, is Santa here? No, Santa's not here. He went back to the North Pole, but there was this great story earlier about just, you know, you got to give it away to keep it. Well, I didn't know this for a long time, but I was really depressed, and you know, eventually I wanted to go back out with my other program, Alcoholics Anonymous. And if the key is sharing it with others and doing service, and you are not kind of a little bit touched with Al-Anon, but like kind of fucked with Al-Anon, like I am, you can't do that. I mean, you can try. I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it. And so, like, my Al-Anon role is I know everything. Like someone just said, do we need chairs? I'm like, no, we're good. I don't know. I just say stuff. I mean, maybe we need 8 chairs. I don't know, but I say stuff, and I say it as if this is the law. When you sponsor, you're supposed to, apparently you're also supposed to ask questions. I'm still working on that. But listen, ask questions. Oh, this is a good one. You're not supposed to buy anyone's drama. So anyway, you get the picture. I couldn't sponsor, couldn't do the 12th step. And it says in there, when all else fails, help another. Well, I can help me another. I tell you, I'll dress you, I'll clothe you, I'll take you all around. And then I'll get overwhelmed and you can't reach me. I'll have 16 sponsors and I'm like queen of AA, and then, you know, Stacy's having a bad year. We don't know what happened. It just doesn't work. So that's my recent problem of about 19 years ago. So what I think kind of got me there, Sissy and I, is oh my God, I love my family, and also I sometimes feel like I had so much fun with my family, and when I just want to just kind of with my heart, we all know. People, I've met people in the program. I don't know how you tie your shoes. You should be dead. I mean, I know I should be dead, but like, I don't think I could live through a good quarter of what I hear in the rooms. I really don't. And, you know, as part of the Al-Anon thing, it wasn't that bad, but it wasn't in some ways. But, in my Al-Anon joke, somebody told this to me, but it really is what I'm learning. I'm still learning today is, you know, there's the three folks in hell, and one is the priest, and one's a rabbi, and one's an Al-Anon. And they're kind of in the hell lobby. Apparently there's like a lobby. And, they're really hot. And the rabbi says, "Jeez, I'm so hot. What did you do to get here?" And the priest is like, "Well, I had a little trouble with that, you know, no dating thing. I had a little trouble with that. How'd you get here?" And the rabbi says, "Oh my gosh, I loves me a pork sandwich." And then they turn to the Al-Anon and they say, "How'd you get here?" And she's like, "It's not hot and I'm not here." not my joke, you know, some brighter, smarter, everything I say usually comes from someone else except this part. And that's part of the thing. You feel insane, right? You mean, you kind of feel insane, but you learn to be like, it's not hot and I'm not here. And it can be scary, you know, criminal abuse and stuff. And people live through that. So when our parents were, you know, we're from Montana, our parents were, perfect for each other, both alcoholics, and I was telling someone the other night when my mom started Al-Anon, I was one, Bon was 2.5 or something, and she found out they're living in married student housing, and you know she gave up her schooling and her whole thing because she was you know almost 6 foot and brilliant and bossy and. But she gave all that. She's going to be the wife, and when he go to school, she finds out he hadn't been in school for like a year because he's drinking. And so she's like, "I'm going to go to Al-Anon." So she went with their best girlfriend to Al-Anon in Missoula, Montana. And so she thought they got a sitter, the whole thing. This is it, you know, because that's pretty bad. He's not in school. We're broke. I got two kids, and he's a bad one. They go to Al-Anon, which was fine. She and Mary Lou. And then they went out for the drinks. And so as she tells it, she says, then we started going to more meetings a week. Because they got a sitter and go out for drinks after. So the Al-Anon didn't really last at that point. So then they're both drinking and they got divorced and stuff. And I was one and Bob was 2.5. And we'd go back and forth. And so they like to get back together, though, to kind of, I think it was to stay in fighting shape, sort of. So they get back together. You kind of never knew if they were married or not. Everyone thought they were married, but I think it was my mom, amazing woman. We were on welfare, and we moved to Helena with Mom, Bonnie, and I. And she was a secretary, and I can't remember. She just thought this world is a mess, and I'm gonna run for the legislature, and. So there we were on food stamps and walking around Helena with the dog and knocking on doors. And sure enough, she became a legislator. And the lights had never been turned out in the state capitol before. This was in 1972, and she was just like, "You're wasting electricity." But the thing is, it's the farmers that are, you know, usually it's the male farmers back in the day, and they're the legislators, and they have a farm and subsidies. The rest of the year, my mom didn't have anything, so we're, you know, again, just scraping by, and she got a gig working at fire lookout, and so we spent 2 summers on the fire lookout, just running around naked, eating berries, and we used to bathe in the cow trough. And then one day, this guy came to the mountain with a friend, and he was from California. And he said, "Barbara, I've heard you got this part-time thing." And they were smoking pot and singing Eagles and drinking boxed wine, as one does. And he said, "I got a way for you to make money, and you give me $3,000 a trip. You just pretend you're my wife, and we'll bring some pot across the border from Mexico." At first she said no, but she said yes. She did that a few times, and then she wrote legislation for medical marijuana. in 1972 in Montana, and her opponent had a poster made of her standing at a bus stop handing out marijuana lunches to little kids. So she didn't make it. She didn't win that year. So then we upped the other program. The family business became smuggling, and I mean, you know, law smuggling. I was in third grade, but I was 8. Bon was 7 and a half, and we were living with my dad at the time. And her partner got a DUI. They'd barely made it across the border, and he got a DUI, and all this is a camper, and all this marijuana is in the hood. So he got the kibosh, and my mom had to find another partner. So my ex-husband, who I hate and love, you know, he'll be good. And so as they tell it, you know, in later years, we're like, so what were you thinking? And my mom, they were both like, well, you know, we didn't have childcare. And so we became, eight and seven and a half. And it's kind of interesting now when you have kids, you're like, that's quite small. You know, like you're out of diapers, but, you know. And we knew, and we called it family secret. And so third, fifth, and sixth grade, we did these trips to Mexico. And you know, the alcoholic family, it's like, my dad loved to have a surprise. So it would be like 2 days before. Now, when you go into school today, drop by the principal and tell him you're going to be gone for a couple months. Oh, where are we going? Oh, we're going to go to Mexico for family business. Oh, yay. You know, you just, I mean, it's fun. Bring a nice outfit because, you know, you got your flip-flops and all your stuff. But there's this whole thing, which we knew, which, you know, you feel, and this is the thing, you know, when you're in that family, this is what you do. You don't go to, you don't, you know what, that's, I'm going to go ask the neighbors. Do they do that? No, you don't go ask the neighbors. You don't ask anybody. But they did tell us, because Mr. Wonderful, who was the kingpin, Jerry Wills, out of L.A., he had, you know, a very practiced program, and so you had to, you know, go down, we'd drive, fly to L.A., get a camper from him, and drive to Oaxaca, or, you know, which was, now, that was hot. We would be up on the little bed. You know, just looking, and then when they'd fill the camper at night and return it, and then we would know it was, you know, you'd know it was in there, and Bonnie and I are back there kind of dying with the fumes, and then you'd stop at close to the border, Ensenada or something, and then wash the camper, and then throw dirt at it, which was confusing. So we asked her why. We had to wash the wheels and stuff, and then he'd go around throwing dirt at it. And we're like, because you can't have the red sand from further down south. And Mom was scraping the sticker off because you can't have that you were there that long. You just went down. Then Jerry, Mr. Wonderful, would drive down in Cadillac or whatever and give us Twinkies, the daily paper from the day before from San Diego. And we dress up all cute, not like we had been in Mexico for a while. So you kind of get the idea of just make-believe, and also perfect setup for the other diseases. You're just invincible, you know, invincible, just like because it worked, you know, each time. And there were definitely mishaps. I mean, you know, they had a rule, no smoking on the road, but they fudged with that a little, and Dad took us like off the High Sierras into a ditch. We thought we were going to die. You know, and we're yelling, and he was in a blackout, and we're up in the top of the camper, seeing the cliff, and then back, and then one night, I think it was on the third trip, we were 9 or 10 or something, there was a, we got stopped, and you're not supposed to drive at night, but you got to make time if you got a load, you don't want to take your time, and we were stopped, Bon and I were asleep in the top, and we were woken up with federales and AK-47s under the bed searching, and we could hear our parents out in the desert. And you know, we got through that one, too. So that's kind of how the early life. And I was thinking the other day, I'm a chronic thumb sucker, and I have how many years? a few years. But I stuck my thumb until 18, and I never made the connection that just that security, and they put like hot stuff on it or whatever. You know, then as soon as that came out, the alcohol would go in at 12. I think I was 12 and you were 13, and blackout immediately, which was great. It didn't cause me any. You kind of assess yourself for injuries, you know, broken toe and the scar there and whatever. So I guess the Al-Anon thing that really, you don't know, you know, the trauma, make-believe, not being in reality, being in fantasy, being in that closed loop where you don't have outside input. It's very isolated. And then also this enmeshment. That's the thing that really brought me to my knees. Like, you know, when I first came to Al-Anon, it was like, you know what? I don't even want to go because nobody is going to understand how much I love my dad. I love him. He's the best. And it's killing me. Nobody's going to understand that. It doesn't make sense, you know? It just doesn't make sense. So then, you know, started drinking alcoholically, and then we continued, you know, then it started to be, I don't know at what point do you take over. I've struggled with this responsibility where you could say no or whatever you're supposed to say, but that didn't come for years and years. In high school, you know, you get a call, or you get a, I got a call one time in school. They'd bring me a note to the office, and it said, I need you in Vegas tonight, you know, and I'm in Kalispell, Montana. Because he needs help driving the load and he's tired. And then I think one of the last, we were in high school and he had a deal out of Jamaica or something. And so he said, oh, we're going to drive to Georgia. And which we did. We drove to Georgia in this little truck. But then they rented a big Cadillac with some kind of, I don't know, some kind of special converter that you can't tell it's heavy or something, and massive trunk. And I think Bonnie had her driver's permit. I didn't have a license. But, you know, they filled that baby up, and she and I got to drive it home. And, of course, if you know Bonnie, you know she speeds. So we got pulled over. I don't know what state that was. Some state between Georgia and Montana. And it was one of those first little, what were you talking about, defining moments? It was one of those first little things that was like, we're pulled over. We're like, on the one hand, we're invincible. On the other hand, this isn't good. And our parents drove by in their truck. You know, in retrospect, it would not have been helpful to stop, probably. Why are you driving separate? Why do you have large trunks? But it was that weird, like, that's, you know, that's not very nice. So that was a little bit, you know, we, you know, and then you're like, well, it's not hot and I'm not here. You know, it's like, and unfortunately, you know, it's one of the things too, you know, as I have kids and I have a daughter who's an addict, and you do kind of, I get now where you pray for, you know, a little early juvie time would have hit the spot, you know, like, you know, you want to have the intervention as early as possible, and there's nothing wrong with a little jail time. And it is kind of actually not great, you know, you keep getting away, you keep getting away, and then you know, the reality is just kind of turn. And I think, but I think the hardest part, our parents, you know, very, very loving, and, you know, it was always like, we adore you. We love you. We adore you. Everything is for you. But when they would fight, and they did, and my mom had an affinity for, what do you call them? Power tools. You know, so she's sanding the floor when we lived in Missoula, and you know that sander was going to go after dad, you know. There are big divots in the floor because she's pissed, you know. And then, God damn it, Charlie, you know. And she's, but, you know, she didn't get him. But you're scared to death. And that's where, you know, it's like, wow, you know. And you don't have that outside. And again, the reality check. And you build that tolerance. And here's the thing, I kind of been reading about, you sort of go back and try to figure out what happened. Is this like, numbness, that kind of numbness that you thank God, you know, to get through. And we ate more than our share of donuts, you know. You know, the donuts, the thumb, the numbness, early sex, hopefully with an alcoholic, hopefully during a blackout, you know. All those things, the numbness and then recreating the and also an addiction to excitement. That's a hard one. And then we moved to Lakeside and they got together again and she had a chainsaw at one point and went after him and cut the car and stuff. So that's, oh gosh, you know, because I want to finish what it was like. It did escalate like one night he was high on coke and Bonnie was gone and he said, we called them the men with shiny shoes. They were coming. We didn't know when, but someday they were coming. And he said they were out back and it had snowed and he kept sending me out. I'd never seen him. He was like shaking on my floor and he was hitting his bottom with coke and he was like, they're out there. They're out there. So what do? You send me out there. And and it's like, I come in, I'm like, they're not out. They're out there. They're out there. Go check again. Okay, you know, go out again. They're not, you know, and it was that excitement and the love too of, but then it became in the end, we were really worried. I can't remember. I went to school. She left me and went to school. I do want to say the first time my parents lived, you know, it's all her fault. You still have my shirt on too. The first time we separated, my mom said, it was the first time we separated, so I always had my sister, and she said, why don't you come in with me? For some reason, the last time she moved out, and I said, okay. I kind of did the hero thing, Missy over here. She'd go under her bed and read Anne of Green Gables, but, you know, both equally painful, and so I said, I'll go, and that's when I, next thing I knew, I ate a box of donuts, went out in the woods and threw up. Yeah, I don't want to gross anyone out, but it's like now I see, well, you took my sister. She was my higher power, you know. So we went to, I guess where this, you know, the smuggling went to is that it got really big and they were doing shipments out of Thailand and all this stuff. And I got this little scholarship to go to Oxford to study, of course, comparative law. And so we didn't have the money, and so my dad calls Mr. Wonderful and says, will you just take, you know, take about 300 grand in your dress, and I'll pay for the comparative law. Oh, good. Okay, that works. And so Bonnie, we learned how to fill up our jumpsuit. It was really uncomfortable having these guys put all this money in our jumpsuit and our dresses and, you know, $250,000, 300 grand. And Bonnie went first. And went to Amsterdam to wait for me, and I went a couple days later, and Jerry, Mr. Wonderful, said, you know, and it's not illegal, you can take money, you know. And then he says, but here's my attorney's card. I'm like, okay. And people will say, like, well, how did you not know? Because, what, we were like 19 or something then. Well, because it's not hot, and I'm not here. It's like, he says it's okay. My dad says it's okay. I'm just going to further my education. But he also said that there would be no stop-off for my plane. It was supposed to be straight to Amsterdam. And when we landed at Gatwick, I was like, and he said that we would land in London, but that I would be in the same little terminal. I wouldn't have to go through security. And when you've got, you know, $250,000 on you, it's a lot, and it pokes, and it's hot, so you have a purse that has to be specifically a really nice leather purse, and you go in the bathroom and, you know, occupy the bathroom for like a half hour getting the money out, and you sleep with the purse, and then before you land, you go back in, you get it all in, and you wear a dress that kind of like that. So I kept the money on, and I got off at Gatwick, and I'm like walking up the thing, and then I see all the security. And everybody's going through the thing, and I'm like, oh, holy crap. And I just did what we do. I'm a super good liar, and I just I ran back down the plane. I said I lost an earring or something, and I thought, you know. But when I came up, you know, it was empty except for there were a lot more guards. And, you know, like, that's not normal, I guess, to run back on the plane and go to the bathroom for a half hour. So they took me in and had me lift up my dress, and there I just had all this money on me. And again, you know, they let me go. Why? Well, it turns out they like cash coming into the country. But also we were being watched already. So, you know, I don't know what happened. I just know that I went into that place. You know, some people talk about, what do you call that? That thing. Yeah. Kind of like, whatever, you know, and they're like, what's up? I like to shop, he says. And I got to Bonnie, and, you know, the person taking the money from us was this, you know, fugitive, and he was hitting on Bonnie, and he was about 89, and then she went and dropped me off at Oxford, and you know, I drank my ass off, I puked my guts out, we took a tour one day to Cambridge on a bus, and I didn't get back on. Everyone else did. I slept in a box in a doorway. And that's that thing about, I hate myself. I am bad to the core. I am bad. I'm pretending it's okay, but at that point, long before I knew I was bad, we were just bad people. But you love your family. So the last deal was my dad went to Singapore. He was really broke, and this kingpin said, I need you in Singapore. And he was gone for 3 or 4 months, I think 4 months. And we were ski instructors, too. We were in Jackson Hole skiing because, you know, you don't care if you die. So we were good skiers. So we got a call in the middle of the night one night, and he said, it's going to be okay. And he had no money to come home. And we were really sad and worried. It's going to be okay. Jerry says you can come see me. I can't come see you. So again, we did the whole money thing. And at that point, I was like 210 or something. I was super gray and bloated. My eyes were dead. Bond didn't look so hot either. I won't go into it. And when we came off of that plane in Singapore, and saw in the airport, it said, you know, drug smugglers will be shot. And you can't throw your gum down there. You literally cannot put gum on the sidewalk. And after that, you know, we went home. He eventually came home, and the shipment, it was 32 tons of Thai marijuana, came into your great city of Vancouver. You're welcome. It got busted, so don't hate us. But I wanted to die. You know, we wanted to die, I got to go faster. So our cousin was left a treatment center in San Francisco, tried to kill himself several times, and they called me. My family called and said, "Come down. We're going to help rescue Brett." And I thought, great, because I got my shit together, even though I want to die. And we told them to go back to treatment. So we're all in the hotel, my dad, my sister, and I. And then they turn around, and I'm getting ready for bed. And I'm like, "What? What are you looking at?" And then they did an intervention on me. Fuckers. And the thing about addiction is I don't think you could be more enmeshed. Like, I would almost, you know, I would do anything for my sister and my mom and my dad. But in that moment, I thought, fine, you're dead to me. I just went to bed, and I was like, don't ever talk to me again. My flight's at such and such a time. And I just got it, and I was like, you're dead to me, because that's how you choose. So I did get sober, and by the grace of God, and, you know, and I went to OA like I told you before, but after how many years in the room? I think it was about 12 years. And what I do is I love people. I mean, really, I just want to eat people up. And sometimes there's one gal in my AA group, you guys know who she is, and one day she goes, could you please not touch me? And I said, do I touch you? And she goes, all the time. Because You know, and also I don't have boundaries, but I just, but I don't know from loving you until it kills me. Okay, thank you, honey. To taking care of myself, you know, and one of the things in Al-Anon is I will give myself away to you if you will give yourself away to me. Deal? You know, to the depths of hell, you know. So taking care of myself, well, then you hate yourself, but you're supposed to take care of yourself, and then you're supposed to sponsor to, you know, to connect with, reconnect with your miracle. And like I said before, I would sponsor and, you know, and then we attract people. And I don't know how to say no. I didn't know you could have a certain number of sponsees. I just didn't, you know. And then I would, often for me, I would relapse with my eating disorder. And also, P.S., I had not done my amends. And this guy took me to lunch one day, and he said, "What's the deal with your amends?" And that was the same time, year 12. I got a sponsor that was, for me, I was lucky. She was AA and Al-Anon. And I have no trouble telling, I'll tell this lady at 7-Eleven, you know, like, "Yeah, I'm a felon," and I, you know, and the people are behind me like, "Can you hurry up, lady?" I don't mind all that, but I would never, it's all about the ninth step for me. At, you know, four through eight. The ninth step. I mean, that's when I felt like I changed. Thank God she was sent to me. She took me through the big book in Al-Anon, very kind of old school. This is exactly how you do it. And she had all these rules. You know, don't buy into their drama. My first sponsee was on house arrest. She was 8 months pregnant, and she needed the book. And I'm like, "Can I buy it?" "No, you can't buy her the book. She'll figure out a way to get it." I mean, she, you know, and lo and behold, she figured out how to get it. I've had lots of sponsees. They can't seem to find the book. And then it's like, well, you know, call me when you do. So that, and also they come to you. That was huge. You don't like, oh, you know, and you don't change the day. It's like we meet at Tuesday, you have an hour and 15 minutes, the first 15, you check in, then we do the book, and you come to me, and you know the hardest one, she's like, "And I know you, don't make them tea." I'm like, "What do you mean don't make them tea? It could be the dead of winter. Don't make them tea. Don't make, if they need a drink, bring it themselves." I mean, this to me is like, but what it did is it freed me up to, I could sponsor, I had the boundaries, I sponsored two people. And sometimes people will start to think, "Oh, you have my answer." You know, this one girl's like, "I love your car. Your husband's cute. I need you to sponsor me." I'm like, "Well, he's for rent. So, but the car, but like, you know, it's the same answer. It's not the person." And she taught me, it takes a couple years, and then they're like friends for life, like my little lovies. Lisa's not my sponsee, but, you know, people, they become your sisters, you know, and you need to be able to take them all the way through and do the deal, and that takes boundaries. And then I feel better, and then, you know, it goes back and forth, and then they sponsor. You guys know this, but I didn't know it because, again, I only know how to, one of the things I was taught, I know how to neglect myself, and I know how to indulge myself, but I do not know how to take care of myself. It's in here. And so I'm not perfect by any stretch, but I don't think I go as far here or here. And when I neglect myself, you know, I want a sheet cake and and that's great. I'm glad I have all these diseases because they're like, "What the hell, Stacy? What's going on?" "Oh, well, you know, I'll call Barbara and she'll say, well, you know, how many meetings you've been to? Do you need a nap?" Self-care. I can't be going out left and right. I also can't have a million friends. My friend Danny taught me, be careful who you bring into your shell. I mean, like, we're sick people. I'm really sick. I shouldn't be here. Lots of things with my body don't work. But I'm healthy and sober and all that today. But I will die. if I do some of these things, especially drink, but if I don't practice my Al-Anon program, I will have trouble with every relationship, and then I will get depressed, and then I will pick up, and that, you know, how it goes. So it turns out I need what we call extreme self-care, and it's okay and it's good, and then people see us do that. So, you know, I lost my train of thought, but she took me through the steps, and I think one of the hardest things was, I'm going to go back a little bit, was, you know, my, oh, yeah, I went to law school. So I got sober 1987, July 18th, and which was about 2 months after Singapore. So rather than kill myself, I left Montana. I drove to Seattle to get into treatment. And you know what? There was no room at the inn. And they were supposed to take me in, and then there weren't enough people or something, so they didn't have it. And that was a miracle, because people always rescued me, and one of them being my sister. And for me, at that moment, it was good that there wasn't treatment, because I had to do it. And I really remember thinking, well, damn, I wanted it to be this thing where they all helped me. But it was just me. I could pick up, I could do the thing, or I could go to a meeting, which is really, you really got to do the thing if you're going to a meeting. There's nobody cares if you come back. I mean, they do care, but it's like, you've got to, you know, we're powerless, but we're not helpless. And so I had that grace and started going to meetings. But meanwhile, this ship had landed in Vancouver about 2 hours north. And so our parents were still doing the smuggling and, you know, finishing it up or whatever. I don't know what you call it. But this shipment got busted, finally, this 32-ton shipment. And the kingpin and this other guy were caught with, you know, $3 million in cash. That was in 87. And then the Royal Mounted Canadian Police granted bail, so you can guess what they did. But then we thought, you know, all my life, though, we have been waiting for the men with shiny shoes. But that's fine. You know, if your parents didn't smuggle or whatever, and you had, you know, what, you're still kind of waiting for the men with shiny shoes. You know, like you know you're in trouble all the time. Like, you're bad. You just know that. That's how I wake up, bad. I used to. But I, you know, got sober doing the deal and had a couple years. And I'd always wanted to be an attorney. And so I went to law school. And, you know, in San Francisco, and it was amazing. And I started the first group in the law school, and we called it the Beyond a Reasonable Doubt group. And you know what? Like, five people came, and they were. It wasn't you guys. It was hard. They kept making me put a piece of paper in the only window. They didn't want anyone to find out. You know, it was really hard. And so it lasted a year or so, and then it kind of. And then there was, right at the five-year statute of limitations, an indictment issued. And our dad was indicted along with these, like, 10 people around the country. And I thought I was going to die. It's really weird. It's like when you love your person, if it's your kid or your husband, and they're dying, it feels like, I don't know why I have to, you're nodding. Yeah, it feels like I'm dying, like a slow, torturous death, and I want to die if it will save them. That's what it feels like. I want to die if it'll save you. And so I started cutting myself when he was indicted, and in December of 92 or 91, and my dad went turned himself in, and then he said they wanted him to wear a wire, and he was like, no fucking way. And but he said, I will tell you everything I know if you promise not to touch my daughters. And I mean, this was a big operation, and we did our couple little things, not to minimize. But the AG, they said, okay. And so then I went to treatment because I was cutting myself, and then an indictment issued for Bonnie and I right after this federal prosecutor promised that he would, and Bonnie went to jail, and that's her story, which just killed me too. And the thing about the night step, when I was in treatment in February, I didn't know there was a warrant out for my arrest, but I was working with a priest and to go through the night, saw the steps, and I said, I think why I'm 5 years, I was 5 years sober. I said, I think why I'm cutting myself and I want to die at 5 years sober is because I haven't done my amends and I've done this thing. I didn't know I had been indicted. And I said, it says in the book, that thing about we'll do whatever we have to do because it doesn't, you know, you can't live free unless you, you know, free yourself, whether it's a crime or whatever. And he said, you know, I think that's a bit much. I don't think he said it like that, but he said, you know, you don't need to do that. You know, that was what, and I don't know if somebody was signing a warrant or whatever, but it was within 3 days or so of, you know, 29 years that the powers that be were saying, no, you do need to face this. This is you. This is, and it'll be okay. It'll be okay. And, you know, it was scary, and but we did know it would be. I mean, there, you know, but we had the program, and that's how I moved in with my husband because there was a warrant out for my arrest. So I met him in law school, and I'd known him 6 months, and he visited me in treatment, which is where I met my parents, and then I moved in with him because it wasn't safe to go back to my law school apartment. And then I was convicted of the felony, and so was my sister. And I thought, well, here, this is not good. I owe like $100,000 for law school. I'm 5 years sober, and I'm never going to get to practice law. And my dad's in prison, and my sister has PTSD because they flew around on Con Air in the night. And I knew, and you people told me, my sponsors, it's going to be okay. And I knew, you just kind of know that, you know, like, you know, when you go to a meeting and there's a woman in there who, there's a woman in our home group who's, her kid is living on the avenue. She, you know, the kid's shooting up and the mom has such a great program. She will meet her at Safeway and buy her food, but she will not give her money and she will not let her come live in her big, huge house. I mean, that's just God. How can you do, you know, because they say my kind of love kills. Stacy's brand of love kills. You know, still when I did appeal for 4 years to two Supreme Courts and the program, you know, Montana didn't understand. They said, you will never be moral. You have no moral turpitude. And P.S., this guy, there was all men on the committee. And they're like, can you explain bulimia? And I was like, what the fuck does that have to do with anything? I said, well, you get a bag of groceries and you eat them all. And what does that have to do with law? You know, but they said, yeah, you're not, you have no morality. You're 5 years, so it doesn't matter. Washington, they have a good program there, and they said, you know, anyway, it took months in committees and went to the Supreme Court, and they let me take the bar exam, and apparently I was the first person to take the bar exam while I was still on probation as a felon, and you know, it did end up, you know, I spent 20-some years defending people exactly like us and like you, you know, and they just come to me. And they know, and I meet all these DUI attorneys, they judge the shit. They know if you're judging them. It's like, well, yeah, I got my DUI my first night of sober drinking. So I get it, you know. They're either ready, they're not ready. We have drug court or they're not ready, you know, all that stuff. But so current day, I'll wrap up with, you know, I have this husband. Oh, my God, he's flying in a couple hours. He's so cute. I sold him his law school books, and I told my friend, I said, I'm going to pick out three guys that I like. She's like, whatever. And I said, he's one. There were 500 in the new class. I was his third year and his first year. I said, he's one. That guy, I like him. And he's my husband today, 21, 2 years later. And we have the most amazing kids. And I just, this Al-Anon disease is my hardest thing because, you know, my dad makes really sad choices, you know, and it's hard to watch. Our mom died sober, which was, you know, mama, I will never, and she got sober first, and boy, we hated her. She was just totally upset in the whole lifeboat situation. But and having a daughter, she's a type 1 diabetic and has celiac disease, and she has done some cutting, and she's depressed and stuff. And I've had nights where, and she's mean as a little rat. Holy crap, she's really scary. And you know, but it's, and I knew right away, she's powerless. She's being a bitch because she's powerless. You know, not like every time right away, but mostly I knew that because I would get to my meeting because I want to fix her and I want to give her advice and tell her stuff and like, and then she has an eating disorder and I want to say to her every day, she eats like a jar of peanut butter a day, and every day I want to say, do you know how many fucking calories is in peanut butter? But I have not said that yet. And she's getting better. And sometimes she asks me to sleep with her. And but you guys taught me when I thought she was gonna, I thought, you know, she wanted to kill herself and she's cutting and she's put holes in the wall and stuff. And I knew right away she was like this big and my son is like a normie and she was sweeping. I didn't ask her to. And I, in the kitchen, I swear to God, I turned around and she had lifted the rug up and she put it under there. I mean, she could barely hold a broom. If that's not genetic, I don't know. Swear to God. My son wouldn't even know how to lie. He's like his dad. So, but I'd get on my knees on the stairs. We have a stairway. I'm scared of her. I have what they call a pre-TSD, which is I'm scared of her. You know, that's the walking on eggshells. It's pre-TSD. I know you're going to, but you tell me I'm supposed to have a boundary to save her. But I'm scared of her, and also, if she doesn't like me, then for sure she's going to get sicker. No, it's the other way around. I want you to live, and that's going to mean you might not like me for 20 years. Oh. I pray on the stairs, and sometimes twice. There's only one flight. But and you know what? It's gotten better, and I'll close with this. This gal at a meeting, I don't even know if she was real, but there's a piece of paper, so somebody put this piece of paper down. But I was sharing something about my daughter. It was just a meeting, and I went back to my seat, and, well, this little angel had written this thing, and it's just perfect. I know it's in here, but it's probably not. Anyway, it's like, you know, it just said, God, please hold, you know, all the perfect words, a little, I am giving you my daughter, my husband, my dad, even if they're deceased. God, I'm giving you this person. Please love them. Help them soar. Help them have their feelings. Help them get through what they're getting through. You know, comfort them. Help me take care of myself. And help me know that you've got the best intentions, you know, that you've got it. You've got it, and I don't have to do it. I didn't cause it. I can't control it. I can't change it, cure it. But that last C, you don't hear it every meeting, and that last C is my work, but I can contribute. I can contribute. And God help me, I do not want to contribute to the death of my little girl. She may die, and they say that too. Sometimes our loved one has to die to get well. You know, our cousin killed herself. She had 16 years. My friend got sober, but then last year he huffed dust cleaner, 50-year-old attorney friend, and he died. We go to a lot of funerals, right? Sometimes we have to die to get it, but don't let me contribute. Please don't let me contribute. So I go to my next meeting, and I'm glad I'm sick as I am because I really am. So there's not a lot resting on my laurels, but it doesn't feel like work. I really like it. I love my meetings. I'm like, what time's my meeting? And when I get home, friends, people, normies, they'll be like, oh, you're in Mexico. We went to this meeting, went to that meeting. And then we did this. Everywhere we go, oh, go see Bonnie. Oh, the Malibu meeting and then that meeting and that. That's all life is. It's these meetings are awesome. So thank you for my recovery and bless you all.